Welcome to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we got a jam-packed show for you this week, cats and kittens. In the question of the week, we will attack the cold weather in the Northeast and Mid-Atlantic with visions of a French hotbed, an ancient technique that allows you to use horse manure to grow greens and maybe even early starts of other plants throughout the winter. We're also going to talk about a great program being run in the Philadelphia prisons that teaches leaving prisoners to re-enter society with horticultural skills, and some really nice references from Temple University and the Pennsylvania Horticultural Society. It's a lot to get done. We better get right to your horticultural questions at 1-888-346-9499. Marty, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hello, thank you for taking my call.
All right, well, thank you for making it, Marty. Where are you, man?
I'm in Bucks County, Pennsylvania, not too far from WHYY up at the north end.
Okay, very good. What can we do for Marty in Bucks County?
Well, my neighbor is a tree trimming guy, and he's got one of those giant wood chipper machines that he drags around and takes down trees. And he dumps all the wood chips down in the back of his property, which adjoins mine. This is good, I think, because I have a nearly infinite supply of wood chips if I need them. But I'm thinking there must be something I can do to these wood chips to turn them into useful garden soil. I also have a good supply of wood ash, which I know is sometimes helpful. But really, I don't know what's in that wood chip pile. It could be pine. It could be other stuff. So I'm just wondering, what could I do to turn these wood chips into something more useful?
Okay. So first of all, what we're talking about is arborist wood chips. So when I trash mulching, wood mulching on the show, I'm mostly talking about the dyed process stuff that could have been old pallets or construction debris. Arborist wood chips are an excellent mulch if used correctly, which means you spread them on the surface of the soil around the plant to be protected. Say you're protecting a tree from mower damage. You only spread them an inch or two deep, and you don't let them within 6 inches of the trunk. That is a perfect use for arborist wood chips because there's no dyes in them, and they are going to naturally degrade and feed the soil. Wood ash is highly alkaline. You really have to be careful. The only good use for wood ash is to, quote, lime a lawn. If you have a lawn that tests very low in pH and you want to bring it more up to neutral, you can use wood ash instead of agricultural lime.
This is great. The mulching, I kind of knew that, but I'm also kind of concerned with, like, I got this great big pile. How long do I let it wait until I have soil? So I got two good answers today. And as far as back to the wood chips, you know, the pile sits there and sits there and sits there. I could potentially go in and stir it up with a front loader, but you think I should just let it sit? Would it make good soil eventually if you let it, the arborist chips, sit for 2 or 3 or 4 years?
The more you turn them, the quicker they will become compost. Were you to go into there with a front-end loader now and move the top three-quarters of the pile, depending on the number of years it's been there, the bottom quarter may already be compost. It'll always be finished on the bottom because that's where the heat concentrates and that's where the composting begins. It's also where the worms can come in and out of the earth to work the chips. And as soon as they start to break down, the more it's attractive to the worms, the more they come in, the faster it composts. So there's probably already some good compost at the bottom. If you want to go to Starbucks and Dunkin' Donuts and local coffee shops and take away all of their spent coffee grounds, which they're desperate to get to a good home, and mix those in as you turn it, now we're maybe talking about 2 years, and we're talking about better quality compost.
I really need compost for my veggie garden this coming spring, so that's really good news, and I will go out there and dig around and see what it looks like at the bottom of that pile.
You may be surprised. If the pile is big enough and it's been there long enough, it could be warm at the bottom, even in this weather.
Oh, that's great. Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate it. I've got mulch and compost potential, so that makes this big pile even more attractive to me. So thanks very much.
Absolutely. Arborist wood chips are great things.
Perfect. Thank you.
All right. Take care, man. 1-888-346-9499. Pam, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thanks a lot.
Well, thank you, Pam. How are you?
I'm excellent. Thank you.
Where is Pam excellent?
Philadelphia, Pennsylvania.
Okay. Well, you got to give us a neighborhood then, Pam.
Oh, I'm up in the far northeast near the Franklin Mills.
Oh, okay. Very good. What can we do for Pam? Not in the great northeast, the far northeast.
A few years ago, at the bitter end of the planting season, I spied a little rose bush that nobody wanted to take home, and I brought it home. First year, it was gorgeous, beautiful buds, beautiful plant. Second year, excellent. Third year, it budded. It was gorgeous, and something looked like it was eating it.
Mm-hmm.
I did all the research, aphids. I got horticultural oils, and, I mean, I don't think I left any stone unturned, but it continues. I don't see anything on the plant. There's no spider webs. I went out with a magnifying glass, turned the leaves over. I'm stumped.
Oh, that's interesting. I just want to point out that spiders are good. Finding spider webs on the plant would mean that spiders had discovered the pests and were eating them for you.
Oh, okay. Good to know.
What's the symptoms of your eaten roses?
It's just got these little holes in it all through it, and then the buds don't fully open.
Mm-hmm.
After the first bloom of the season, this occurs, and it starts to almost look like it's dying from the bottom up.
Okay, but the leaves have a lacy appearance.
More like holes in them rather than lace.
Okay. What kind of sun does it get?
It gets a good amount of afternoon sun.
But not morning sun?
Not morning sun.
Okay, so that's a bad situation for a rose. Roses are very disease prone, and they really like that morning sun to dry them off. Is there any mulch at the base of the plant?
No.
Okay, good. Is the plant fed?
Yes.
What is it fed with?
I couldn't tell you right now. It's a commercial product specifically for roses.
Yeah, but it's a chemical plant food.
Most likely.
Yeah, so don't do that. When you feed a rose chemical fertilizers, it grows unnaturally fast, and that growth is weak.
Makes sense.
Yeah, so that it's very attractive to pests and diseases. Do you prune your rose, and when?
Yes, I prune it early fall before it gets cold, but it's just a little cool.
Okay, that's very bad for the plant. So how big is this plant now?
It's pretty tall now. I'd say it's close to 5 foot.
Okay, so it's a healthy rose. Do you have any interest or ability to move it in the spring?
I can't move it.
Okay, understood. Okay, so what I want you to do is, in the spring, a couple of weeks after new growth appears, I want you to give it a good pruning then. I want you to remove all of your prunings and get them away from there. I want you to spread 2 inches of yard waste compost underneath the plant. So it doesn't sound like you've got a lot of plants, so you should be able to buy a bag of really high-quality compost at a local garden center.
Not with the yard waste compost.
Yeah, not... It may say lobster compost, it may say coast of Maine, but what you don't want is composted manure.
Okay.
And then after the first flush of roses appears, cut them right away and bring them inside to adore them. Now we're entering the period of time where the rose starts to have problems, right?
Yes.
So I want you to do 2 things. I want you to buy a Japanese beetle trap. And I want you to set it up right next to the plant and check it every day. When you catch your first beetle in it, take the trap down and put it in the back of the house or as far away from the rose as you can. And then keep a good eye on the plant. You may even want to cut it back so there's not a lot of material for the Japanese beetles to feed on. Throw a sheer curtain over it for a week, because by then all the Japanese beetles will have establish their territory on other people's roses, and then it's safe to take the curtain off. We also don't know that that's the cause, so I also want you, at the first sign of damage, to put out little saucers of beer at the base of the plant. crack the beer at sunset and fill up a couple of containers and put the fresh beer at sunset around the base of the plant. If you have slugs doing the damage overnight, then they will be caught in the traps, and then you'll know that you have slugs. And you can control those by just putting out, you know, fresh beer once a week. They're attracted to the yeast, and they'll crawl in and drown. And oh, and don't prune after late summer.
Okay.
Because that the new growth will freeze, and you'll weaken the plant. So do your pruning in the spring. Be sure you deadhead all the roses that you leave on the plant as soon as they've faded. Do the ring of compost. Test for beetles. Test for slugs. And I think you'll find the culprit. Good luck to you next season.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Take care, Pam.
You too. Bye-bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and remind everyone in areas that dip below freezing that rock salt, often disguised by the initials NaCl, is the worst choice for plants, pets, and surfaces when ice is an issue. Instead, use play sand or alternative de-icers like calcium chloride, magnesium chloride, and potassium chloride. But don't go checking your labels for the initials NaCl just yet, because we'll be right back with a hot bed and cold calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Support for You Bet Your Garden is provided by the Espoma Company, offering a complete selection of natural organic plant foods and potting soils. More information about Espoma and the Espoma Natural Gardening Community can be found at espoma.com. And High Caliper Growing, creators of the original Smart Pot, Big Bag Bed, and other fabric growing containers made in the USA. Remember, the container you use affects the plants you grow. SmartPots.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up in just a little bit, we'll tell you about French hotbeds, a 17th century way of growing lettuces and early starts outdoors in a cold frame with heat from manure. It's an interesting concept. You don't want to miss it. We're also going to take lots more of your fabulous phone calls. But now it's time for me to discuss a program from the Philadelphia prison systems that I really like. It is time to welcome my special guests from the Department of Prisons in Philadelphia, the people responsible for the Managing Urban Greening and Sustainable Land Care Program, which is part of a career-focused educational reentry program designed to get prisoners who are leaving incarceration good jobs, good trades, good skills. And they're here specifically because those trades and skills are in the field of horticulture. It is a really well-recognized program around the country. We've talked about it a bit in the past, and now it's time to give them our due. We will start with Nicole Westwick, who is an associate vice provost of Temple University, and she's in charge of the Urban Greening and Sustainable Land Care Program. Nicole, first, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you.
And now tell us a little bit about the program and, for instance, Temple University's involvement in it.
So this is a program between Temple University where we've designed the curriculum. It's a 10-week program that the men complete while they're still incarcerated. They all become eligible for early release through the district attorney's office, and then they are placed into a 10-week internship paid where they gain sort of those full on-the-job training skills.
And we have with us here a former student, Keith Boone. Keith, thank you for coming in today, man. Early release and you get paid. Who in their right mind wouldn't want to be part of this program?
Not only that, I did it because I like to do different things. You know, my grandma had a garden, man, so I like to not only plant things. I want to grow my own food instead of just going to the market and get it, you know. I'd rather do that than not knowing what I'm getting.
You do want to get a job in the field, right?
Yeah, actually, I was working in the field when I got finished, actually, with PHS. But, you know, that was a temp job, so it's a short amount of time. Looking to also go back to work with PHS, hopefully, you know, because I liked it. And I really believe it helped me. That's why I jumped at this opportunity to come up here. I mean, when I was asked to come, I said, sure, because I had a great time. I mean, the experience at Bartram Gardens was so nice, you know. We built things, stuff like that, so I liked it.
We should tell people around the country, PHS is the Pennsylvania Horticultural Society.
Yes.
They do greening programs all throughout the year, and they hold the Philadelphia Flower Show in March pay for it. You going to the flower show?
I went, and that was actually my first time there, and it was beautiful, man. Actually, even some of my past classmates, they had stuff up there, I mean, awards that they won for it. So it was a great experience. That was my first time going, and I really liked it.
Now, I'll be honest, one of the reasons you're on the show and this group is on the show is I worry about people who are released from prison who've done their time being able to find work, because there's that stigma. Do you find that the fact that you worked with plants and you have this connection with the Philadelphia Flower Show, you worked at Bartram Gardens, one of the oldest public gardens in the world. Do you think people look at you a little differently than just, you know, there is no such thing as an average ex-con, but let's call it that.
All right. Not even. It's about me. I the way I carry myself, I mean, I wake up every day and being happy. And I've been around a lot of different people all over the city. I lived in Southampton, lived in Pottstown. So I've been around. I mean, people only going to judge you by how you carry yourself. I mean, if you carry yourself a certain way, I mean, they're going to carry you that way. If you're carrying it in a bad manner, I always smile.
Yeah, but so, you can be smiling carrying a plant.
No, I'm smiling every day. That's the first thing I do when I wake up. I mean, I'm happy. I'm happy to be here. And, man, I know a lot of people that don't get the chance to even be in a studio to talk about the experience like that I went through in this spring class. And I'm just thankful. I'm thankful for it, you know what I mean?
Laura Cassidy, you are the sustainability manager for the Department of Prisons. You were on previously a couple of years ago talking about the amazing composting program in the Philadelphia prisons. There have been a number, I know you guys call them cohorts, I'm going to call them classes. There have been quite a few graduating classes of people like Keith so far through this program, right?
Yes, we've had 7 cohorts thus far with Temple University since the program started. You mentioned that I was on the show several years ago, and originally this all just started with composting.
It all starts with composting. That's what I keep telling people.
And I am a firm believer in composting, and I was starting a recycling program, and it was not a formal vocational certificate program. It was just another job at the Department of Prisons. And it kind of morphed into more under Mayor Nutter's administration, making the city of Philadelphia the greenest city in the nation. Then they decided that they were going to hand me the 200 fruit-bearing trees. So then I kind of pitched the idea, why don't we connect it with the compost and bring in a four-year institution? Because, as you know, in this area, we have a lot of great higher education. And I kind of stumbled into Temple University, so we've made an agreement and we've created a formal program. Full disclosure, I am a graduate of Temple, but it was just an accident that I happened into Temple. So this became a formal program, I'd say about a year and a half, 2 years ago with Temple, bridging these programs together.
And the scope of the individual classes is amazing. You have many, many acres, and people like Keith get to experience on all aspects of horticulture.
Yeah, it is quite amazing. A lot of the participants have never been exposed to this. I mean, and you know, most of the people that I encounter are urban. They're from, you know, Philadelphia. We actually, at this point, have the largest urban orchard, I think, in the East Coast. So it's 2.5 acres. So some of these guys have
and
never...
And that's just the orchard?
That's just the orchard. The compost, actually, I just got a grant. I'll give a shout-out to the Mayor's Office of Sustainability. They just gave me additional funding, so I'm hoping to bring our other facilities online. We service 2 of our 6 facilities with the composting. Currently, we're doing about 800-900 pounds of raw food waste a day. So we use that as an additive to our orchard, and we do also give it out for free to community members, and the guys work it, and I explain to them how compost works, and they'll see the rice and beans, and then I'll show them the end process, the black gold, and it's amazing to see the light bulb go on, because a lot of people have never been exposed to this. So now it's a formal program, and we've contracted with Temple University, or partnered with them. And it's also morphing into something even more than that, because now we're going to integrate the Pennsylvania Horticultural Society into this program. Starting in February, it will be a 10-week program. The participants will be exposed to gardening. We have a mini farm going on, and composting, which, you know, I'm a believer of that 100%. And I do believe the city of Philadelphia is on the brink. The industry is on the brink. So the jobs are not here for composting just yet, but they will be here because a lot of states are making it mandatory that food waste just does not go into landfills.
Right. So Nicole from Temple, we're talking about the orchard, but there's so much more. And this is mainly at one big facility in Northeast Philly, right?
The students take classes at 3 different sites, basically, within the Department of Prisons. So our primary classroom is at the compost facility, where they learn about nutrition through the Department of Public Health, through Get Healthy Philly. They gain business skills, resume, interview, how to get ready for job searches. And then they also have experiential learning that happens at the sites where the PHS has greenhouses and facilities, as well as the orchard that Laura described.
Keith, were you at the main facility, or did you come in kind of as a visitor to take these programs?
I was actually there. I've been there. Yes, I have been there. We didn't work in compost. We did a lot of planning and building things. Like, I actually built the compost bin. Actually, in a neighborhood garden. I was West Philly.
So there's a lot of work release involved in this. You get out in the community while you're still...
Yeah, and the experience is what I really like. You know, I like getting up every day and going to go do that. I mean, for the community, because a lot of these communities are not looking too well. I mean, when you see a garden, a place that's trash everywhere, I mean, and people are taken care of, and then it's for the community.
So I mean, you as an ex-prisoner... can go back to a community that breeds future prisoners, and you can do things that make life a little bit nicer in that community and maybe edge off the problem at the beginning.
Right, from the kids, stuff the kids. They see us planting. They like, maybe I could plant some stuff and grow it and feed my family with it. Because sooner or later, we're going to have to do it ourselves. I mean, price is going to be high, real high. I mean, I'd rather plan it myself anyway.
Well, that's interesting, because when you guys came on, I expected you to talk about hoping to get a job at a big greenhouse or a nursery or a garden center or something like that. And obviously, I think you'd be open to that. But the most amazing thing to me is the first thing you talked about is now you can grow your own food. Now you know how to do that.
And how long it take, the temperature, even doing it in my home. You don't even have to do it outside. I mean, so you could have a garden in your house
But if you eventually live someplace where you got a piece of land, it sounds like you're going to have a garden the first year.
Yeah, definitely.
So what are you going to grow?
What I'm going to grow, first thing I'm going to grow some corn. And then money. That's money right there. That's corn is money. I mean, so I could branch out and then grow some more things. And fruit. I love fruit. I mean, mm-hmm. fruit always healthy, man.
Yeah, but your sweet corn in the summertime, there's just nothing like it.
Money.
So, Laura, how extensive are the gardens at the prison? I mean, I'd almost call them community gardens because the prison is a community. How extensive are the gardens there, and how much food do the prisoners get to grow for themselves, essentially?
Well, I don't actually have the statistics for the Pennsylvania Horticultural Society, but they have two very large greenhouses that they operate, which will be fused into our program. The orchard, we have 200 fruit-bearing trees, roughly. And
there are a lot of work.
It is, and people have no idea how much work. And, you know, when I was handed this project, I was not a farmer, but I know a lot about farming now. The 200 fruit-bearing trees in a drip-line irrigation system, and we have, I think, 8 50-foot raised beds as well. And originally, the thought was with the city of Philadelphia was to make us more self-sustaining, but we can't feed everybody in our system. So what we want to do is supplement some of the facilities and also donate it to local community food banks, and I'm working with the EPA and their Food Recovery Challenge program. So I'm going to be forming a committee to figure out a formal distribution thing because I realize the volume is going to be immense.
Nicole, there's a lot of aspects to this because, again, when I invited you guys in, I'm thinking a straightforward, find guys who are interested in this, getting ready for a new career once they get released. The idea that you can get early release and have a little bit of money in your pocket is very enticing. I would imagine that would cut recidivism, just, you know, to have worked towards getting out early, to have a couple of bucks in your pocket and to come out with at least the beginnings of a skill.
Yes, and it does make a difference. So the early release component is modeled on routes to reentry. The average Philadelphia recidivism rate is 65%. Students who complete the routes to reentry program, which has the early release component, have a recidivism rate of 34%. So that's a pretty significant difference.
Yeah, that's almost cutting it in half.
Exactly.
And how many years has this been going on now?
The compost started in 2011. It became a formalized program about 2.5 years ago.
So we're only seeing the tip of the iceberg
now.
As we're taping this show, which is right before Christmas, you have a graduation ceremony. And how many graduates will be in that class?
This is a small cohort, so 6 students.
Okay. Well,
generally, we have anywhere from 12 to 20, generally. So, but this is a small class.
It's 10 weeks, and the next one starts on February 4th, I believe.
That's right.
I would imagine that people like Keith might have better credentials than a lot of people that come looking for jobs. I mean, Temple University, there's PHS. It's not like just, you know, took a couple of classes somewhere. You got some big names behind you.
PHS, I think it played a major part. It taught me a lot of different things, like cloning plants. To even make more than what you got, you go clone a plant and make about different trees and stuff like that. So I learned a lot. Like, that's why when I went to an interview, I talked about PHS and about all the things I did there. Like, it was like a really, really great experience for me and of my classmates, man. So we talked about it all the time. I still keep in contact with a lot of my classmates. And we all think it was a real, real good opportunity. That's why I hopped into it. It wasn't about early release, none of that. It was something different. I wanted to take advantage of it. I mean, take advantage of an opportunity that most people can't get. They not able to get accepted into it. I mean, because you got major crimes on your record. They don't not going to allow you to be in the community doing these things.
Well, I certainly hope that it works out for you, man. I wish you luck. I hope you're building community gardens.
Yeah, I wouldn't mind. Definitely that's, giving back to my community.
That's a great way of giving back. Nicole, it looks to me like Keith may interview well.
Yeah, he's a great interviewer and a hard worker. So if anyone out there is looking for someone really talented and hardworking, Keith may be the guy for them. Yeah.
Well, I meet so many people who are so knowledgeable who can't present themselves. And so I'm happy to hear that presenting yourself and marketing were part of the program. That's not what people would normally think. They'd think that you'd be out there pruning and planting and, you know, digging in the dirt and working in the fresh air and the sunshine, but not so much really sitting across a chair from somebody teaching you how to how to interview for a job, well, what to say, what not to say.
They played the major part. The city of Philadelphia really did. I can say, you know, you go to prison, you know, you go through the different emotions, stuff like that. But afterwards, they got a lot of situations where though they will get you ahead. I mean, they're going to be there for you. And you got to take advantage of what we got. Stop focusing on so much what you don't got. I mean, because it could be a lot worse.
Keith Boone is a former student in the program of Managing Urban Greening and Sustainable Lawn Care in the Philadelphia Department of Prisons. Nicole Westrick is the Associate Vice Provost of Temple University, who's managing that system. And Laura Cassidy is Sustainability Manager for the Philadelphia Department of Prisons. Thank you all for coming in. I am 100% behind this program. I think it's a great idea, and it's where we really need a focus in society today.
Thank you.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and announce a couple of my upcoming appearances. I will return to the Brandywine 100 Library on Wednesday evening, March 7th. Speak at the Bayshore Center in Port Norris, New Jersey, on Thursday evening, April 26th, and at St. Paul's Episcopal Church in Exton, PA, on Saturday, May 12th. But don't go marking up your cute little kitty calendar just yet, because we'll be right back with hot beds and even hotter phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Support for You Bet Your Garden is provided by the Espoma Company, offering a complete selection of natural organic plant foods and potting soils. More information about Espoma and the Espoma Natural Gardening Community can be found at espoma.com. And High Caliper Growing, creators of the original Smart Pot, Big Bag Bed, and other fabric growing containers made in the USA. Remember, the container you use affects the plants you grow. SmartPots.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I am your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up a little later in the show, French hotbeds. It sounds so exotic, doesn't it? And it is in one sense. It's a way of growing outdoors in the coldest region by giving your plants a little extra heat that is more than natural. It's supernatural. We'll tell you about this 17th century wonder that you can imitate after a couple more of your fabulous phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Pete, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hey, Mike, how are you?
I am just ducky today, Pete. How are you, sir?
Not too bad.
Where is Pete not too bad?
We're just down south from you in Wilmington, Delaware.
Very good. Very good. In the small wonder of a state. What can we do for Pete?
So I bought my house down here about 8 years ago, and I planted a fig tree from a cutting. It grew nicely, took care of it every winter, wrapped it in burlap just as you're supposed to.
Good.
This past summer, 70-plus figs.
Okay.
It's going great. I'm absolutely loving it. The problem is, in 12 days, I'm moving.
Mm-hmm.
I'm leaving this house. So I want to know, is it too late in the year to take a cutting of my own from this tree and bring it to my next future house?
And have you had a lot of personal contact with the buyers?
No, not personally yet.
Because the simplest thing to do would be just to craft a little letter, a little one-paragraph thing saying, giving you permission to come back in the spring and take cuttings from the fig tree. Those cuttings will grow like blazes. They are almost guaranteed to survive. If you don't think you can negotiate that simple thing, or you want to try to see if you can do it anyway, it is certainly dormant. So I would suggest you do two things. First, you take cuttings from the youngest wood, the branches that appeared the most recently on the plant. And before you do that, you got to try to find a garden center or nursery that's still open that has potting soil, seed starting mix, you know, a soil-free mix. And take like half a dozen to a dozen cuttings, get a nice big pot, fill it with the seed starting mix, and then take that pot with drainage holes in the bottom and sit it in a sink with a couple inches of water in the bottom for a couple of hours till that pot becomes insanely heavy. And then stick it in the dish drainer until the water drains out the bottom. And take a pencil and make little pencil dents into the soil so that you can put your cuttings in there. Don't jam the cuttings down into the soil. Make little holes for them first. Then you want to get like a clothes hanger or, you know, maybe you got some scrap metal, a little bit of light fencing, chicken wire, and make something where you can drape a plastic bag over top of the pot. And then just every day, lift up the plastic bag and mist those cuttings. They don't need direct sun at this point. They don't want to be too hot. They don't want to be too cold. And with any luck, by the springtime, you will see new growth appearing on some of those twigs, and then you would take them, and I would just, because they're figs, I would just plant them directly in the new spot, which should be an area, you know, close to a house, close to a wall, someplace that you can easily protect, not way out in the open all by itself, and certainly not in any low spot in your new property. You want it to be in the highest point, closest to a wall, a garage, the house, something like that. Your other alternative would be to cut some old wood, some of the bigger pieces, some of the more woody pieces, and literally tie them up with a string, take them to your new property, dig a grave, and drop them in, and then pull those up out of the ground. You would bury them about 6 inches to a foot deep, dig that up in the spring, and do the same thing. Put them, now they can be outdoors in a little pot filled with seed starting mix and see if you can coax those to bloom. Those are your two choices. Softwood cuttings, which would be the newest growth, and hardwood cuttings, which would be the oldest growth. And the softwood you would try to start right away inside. The hardwood you'd bury till spring.
Okay. Now, if I can get them to agree to let me come back and take a cutting in the spring, am I just starting with, like, right at the very new growth to take something off?
Yeah, what you would do is you would do them a favor by trimming off all the dead parts, because you know how to do that. You're used to that experience. And then about a week or two after that, when you got really lush new growth, you would come back and take, you know, 6 to 12 whips and then take them home. And again, with figs like that, if they're really lush already, you might as well just even put that right in the ground and just keep that spot watered.
Okay. They seem like reasonable people.
And
maybe
also,
maybe they'll be amenable to that.
I think they will, because they'll probably want to know how to take care of this plant.
True.
You know,
very true.
Even without the figs, it's a beautiful plant, man.
Yeah. I'm hoping it works out and I get to carry it on to my next place.
All right. Good luck, Pete.
Thanks, Mike. Appreciate it.
Take care.
We'll see you.
1-888-346-9499. David, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thanks, Mike.
Well, thank you, David. How are you, sir?
I'm doing great.
And where is David doing great?
I live in Medford, New Jersey.
Okay, the Garden State. What can we do for David?
Well, I was calling to actually respond to a conversation that you had with one of your callers on one of your shows a couple weeks ago. I think the caller expressed concern that she had a shrub in her backyard that attracted lots of butterflies and flying insects. But that shrub was an invasive, and she wanted to know from you whether or not that invasive should be removed. So I wanted to find out from you whether it should and, you know, what your position is on that.
I'm so glad you called because we need to talk about this from both sides. Sometimes I can get a little flip about these things. Now, when it comes to invasive plants, I have to admit my back stiffens up a little because there's people out there making lists of plants that they think should live and die. And there are plants out there that are less helpful to us as homeowners and guardians of public land than others. But in her case, it was butterfly bush. It was doing a world of good for pollinators. And as you know, butterfly bush blooms constantly throughout the season, so that especially when the monarch butterflies that originally grew up on milkweed, a different plant, but when those monarchs get ready for their migration down to Mexico, they need plants that produce this much pollen and nectar to make that incredible journey. So I know it's not native, but I mean, you look around at any landscape, and let's be honest, how many of the plants are native?
I agree there, but I disagree in that not all plants or invasives are equal to others. And in this case, I come from a background of 30 years in the National Park Service, where I actually managed exotic plant management teams. From my perspective, what I'm concerned with mostly is the impact that exotic invasives have on biodiversity of native species. They really cause endangered species to be at risk. And in fact, they also impact native animals. They displace plants that native fish and wildlife depend on. And they increase the risk of wildfire through things like cheatgrass growing all over the place. So,
right. And one of my fears is that when herbicides are used, then we're directly attacking amphibians mm-hmm. in the area. And a lot of times when we have good intentions and we rip out invasive plants, we may be exposing the area to excessive erosion that maybe, you know, the invasive plant wasn't really feeding anything directly. But as you know, it was probably deliberately introduced years ago because it holds soil in place brilliantly.
Yes, yes, some have. And so, you know, you're talking about cheatgrass, and yes, some have, but some haven't. Some have been introduced inadvertently by landowners. Some have been introduced deliberately.
Well, hopefully maybe we can meet in the middle. I certainly don't mind taking out wild grape and porcelain vine and other things like that, even though they do have uses. There is mm-hmm. wildlife that feeds on them, and all wildlife will shelter in them. But as Hippocrates said, first, please do no harm. Let's not be spraying herbicides that attack amphibians, and let's not accidentally be causing erosion in very sensitive areas.
But following up on your do no harm, the first thing people can do is not introduce exotic invasives in the first place, because in that sense, they stop or slow the spread entirely, and there's no need for use of pesticides. So homeowners and landowners and people who own woodlots really need to understand that they could play a large role in spreading these species and extirpating native species, but they also could play a big role in preventing the spread. And that's really what I wanted to get across and that I thought would be useful for your listeners to hear.
Absolutely. If you're working in a wild area, you need to research everything you plant.
Right.
Thanks for talking it out with me, Dave.
Okay.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
All right, as promised, it's time for the question of the week. Winter got you down? Why not curl up in a French hotbed? Lexis Landis, producer of You Bet Your Garden, warm us up with this week's question.
I'd be happy to. Victoria in East Greenbush, New York writes, last year I had some success constructing cold frame boxes to keep my greens going into winter. I have read about hotbed gardening, saw you mention it briefly in an archived question, and was wondering if you have heard of any success using this method without manure. I was hoping I could maybe accomplish the same results with leaf compost, but wondered if there might be some trick I could try to make it more successful. Okay, McGrath, I'm going to bite. French, hot bed.
Look, it's January. My hands have been freezing since September. When we got her email, the words French hot bed just made me feel all warm and toasty.
Uh-huh, sure. So refresh our frozen minds. What exactly is a French hot bed?
It's a technique that dates back to 18th century French gardeners who were too small scale to afford a greenhouse, but who wanted to grow lettuce all winter and get a head start on growing melons so that theirs would be the first ones in the market. I first learned about it back when I was the editor of Organic Gardening magazine in 1994 from a 1913 book called, quote, Intensive Culture of Vegetables, French System.
Is Victoria correct that manure is involved?
Yeah, you know, whether you were in England, Holland, France, or those revolutionary United States, manure, specifically horse manure, was plentiful and darn useful, especially in the winter when it was used to heat early greenhouses.
Interesting. How exactly was it used?
Well, in many cases, big piles of it were simply placed in a central area of the structure, with the most frost-tender plants positioned close to it. Horse manure gives off a lot of heat as it breaks down. Even after it cooled down, it was pressed into bricks that were then burned for more heat, maybe with some peat mixed in.
But as you say, not everyone could afford a greenhouse.
No, those greenhouses required a lot of physical labor to maintain. They were the play toys and prized possessions of the wealthy and privileged. Washington and Jefferson each had one, of course, and captains of industry like DuPont and Nemours had several, in which they would keep prized fruit trees and tropical plants alive and sometimes even producing over the winter. The French even gave some of the earliest greenhouses plant-specific names. Pineries were used to grow pineapples, and indoor citrus groves were called orangeries.
That is really neat, but didn't they smell bad inside?
Come on, most of the world smelled pretty bad in the 1700s. Anyway, the small-scale hotbed is described as an above-ground wood-framed bed. It's about 4 feet wide by 12 feet long. The frame is about a foot high in the front and sloped to be slightly taller in the back. It's covered with two panels of glass side by side with a wooden divider in between so you can work the plants on one side without making the other side too cold.
Okay, so where's the manure?
It's in a pit underneath. As the weather gets cool, you would excavate the soil underneath the area of the bed to be about 2 feet deep, and you'd replace that soil with fresh horse manure mixed with straw bedding and some aged manure to keep it from getting too hot. Then you'd place your cold frame on top of that, cover the manure with several inches of good soil and or compost to prevent direct contact between your plants and the manure, and then you'd install what you'd be growing in there.
Now, cold frames typically need to be vented on warm and sunny days to keep them from overheating.
And hotbeds even more so, especially early in the season when the nights aren't that cold yet, but the manure is really cooking away. Automatic vents that raise and lower the glass are really a good idea.
And so now we finally approach her actual question. With about 90 seconds left...
That's not even close to a record. Anyway, first, I think this is a great use for actual horse manure. If there are any stables nearby, I'd seriously advocate for historical accuracy. Otherwise, I think the classic combination of shredded fall leaves and spent coffee grounds might work well.
Why only might?
Well, the heat from horse manure is self-generating and surprisingly long-lasting. You'd have to get the combination of shredded leaves and coffee grounds cooking for a day or two to make sure that burying them doesn't prevent their hot composting from lack of airflow. Now, once they are cooking, I think they do fine. Or, if the area is near a grounded outlet, you could instead try a trick devised by the late Mel Bartholomew, father of the square foot garden method.
Mel made a square foot hotbed?
Yes, indeedy. He excavated a 4x4 foot area about 18 inches deep, put down a layer of insulating plastic foam material, covered that with an inch of sand, then he put down a heating mat on top, one that's designed to handle damp conditions. Then 4 or 5 inches of soil and compost on top of the heating mat. Install the plants in cold frame over top, and you've got some toasty roots. You could even run the mat on a timer to mostly stay on just at night. Well, that sure was some interesting info about old school hotbeds, now wasn't it? Luckily for you, the question of the week appears in print at the Gardens Alive website. To read it over in detail, just click the link for the question of the week at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Gardens Alive supports the You Bet Your Garden question of the week. Yikes, my producer is threatening to trip my circuit breaker if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499. Or send us your email, you're tired, you're poor, you're wretched refuse teeming towards our garden shore at garden@whyy.org. Please include your location, especially if you are certain that we do not need it. And visit our website, youbetyourgarden.org, where you'll find the answers to all your garden questions. Audio of this show, past shows, and our podcast. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Terry Murray is our brand new vice president of production. Our old engineer is Al Banks. Our social media director is Amanda McGrath. Check out her fine work at the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page and like us. Webmasters Larissa Sapko and Rich Banowitz keep our website warm. Alexis Landis occasionally produces You Bet Your Garden for WHYY-FM in Philadelphia whenever she feels like it. Our associate producer of Production Association is Brett Rader. Our editor is Al Banks. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and if you think I'm going to play off a French hotbed on the credits this week, you are mistaking me for someone who does not follow the news. Heck, at this rate, I might soon be the last man standing and broadcasting. Al, cue up our closing record of the week, and I will hopefully see you again next week.
Another one bites the dust, and another one gone, and another one gone. Another one bites the dust, hey, hey.
It sure seems that there's a new pest appearing every hour. I'm pestiferous Mike McGrath, and on the next You Bet Your Garden, we'll discuss the newest bad boy on the block, the spotted lanternfly, plus your spotted phone calls. That's on the next You Bet Your Garden.